So Market Street is State Route 18. Cities maintains that and is responsible for that. We have a program called our Urban Paving Program that will pay 80% of most of the resurfacing costs every 10 to 15 years as needed based on condition, and we decide, you know, what the condition is. So we have that. Now, on a state route like State Route 8, which looks a lot more like 77, like an interstate, than anything else, our policy says we'll pick up 100% of that cost, but the city still maintains that. And the effect of that is, because we pay so much for those pavement maintenance projects, we include that in our pavement management system in different ways, but we do include it. Some of the exceptions to responsibilities for that, bridges on those routes, bridges on state routes in cities, and this is a more recent change. ODOT is not just able to participate in that, but we have an obligation to pay for the major maintenance on those. We've done that for a long time by policy, but back in 2007 or 2008, that was codified, and we now are responsible for that. The city still do the routine maintenance.
What about the inspections on those?
We do the inspections, and we're obligated to, on all bridges on state routes, regardless of where they are. We even do the railroad bridges, although that's another change, and that came out of federal law recently. We're not obligated to, but we do.
What about over water with the county?
It used to be that in the city, bridges over water were the county's, and part of that's still true, but ODOT on the state routes over water now has those.
So you kind of trump?
Yes.
Trump the county responsibility.
For our purposes, there is no over water distinction.
Okay.
Now, once you get out into the rest of the city on the other routes, that still takes place. We actually published a little pamphlet a few years back called the Roadway Infrastructure Maintenance something. That you would think it's simple, but it's probably 40 or 50 pages long. It has a bunch of charts and graphs. Who's responsible for what under what circumstances? And even with all that work, there's still some gray area.
Right.
So, you know, when we do pavement management now, that's the system that we're looking at. Now, ODOT also has oversight of federal dollars, so sometimes federal dollars are spent off of that system for other projects outside of that, and we don't manage the pavement on that, but we do have oversight on those federal dollars. So, and what we do on all those routes is every year we do thorough inspections just to look at the condition. We rate those routes using the pavement condition rating. It's a process we've used here in Ohio for many years. We have a lot of background data on it. And it's a distress-related process. So we have two sets of people that drive every one of these routes in the state every year, and they look for distresses. They look for potholes, longitudinal cracks, transverse cracks, rutting, heaving, raveling, all kinds of different distresses related to the pavement. And each segment that's significantly different in condition gets a different number. And those numbers go from 0 to 100, basically. And it's kind of like the grades you used to get in school. If you're 85 and above, that's a pretty good road. And if you're down in the 50s and 60s, you may want to reevaluate where you're at. And that's what we do. We use for our goals now, we try to keep the interstate system above a 65. We try to keep the state system outside of cities above a 60. We try to keep the urban state route system above a 55. There's some other ways to measure pavement condition too. The Federal Highway Administration, really likes roughness. They use something called the IRI. You guys have probably seen some of that.
Yep. And then there's going to be supposedly another one for urban. It's going to be like the roughness, but slightly
and
different.
Used to measure roughness, they would have a certain car, a 68 Chevy Caprice with certain shock setting, and they would measure, and you can't even get that car anymore. But they tried to make it uniform. There's different ways of measuring it now. Usually it's done with lasers now, measuring the bumps in the roadway. And we have to report that to the Federal Highway Administration, so we do some conversions and some of the stuff we measure and calibrate. And it's a decent system. It would be a very unusual roadway to have a high pavement condition rating and a very low IRI, but there are some things that would set it out of whack, especially in cities where you might have a lot of manholes that make it really rough. It also doesn't tell you what you do need to do to fix the pavement. So by knowing what the distresses are, we can get a pretty good idea of what we need to do to fix the pavement. So we still like our PCR, and we're sticking with it for the foreseeable future. About 3 years ago, though, we changed the way we look at things. We always used to do a worst first approach to fixing pavements. So once the pavements got down to a certain point, we'd be putting some money there and resurfacing, basically. And most of the roads had a very similar treatment. But about 3 years ago, we really started hitting preventative maintenance hard. In this chart here, is this high enough that you can see it? Kind of gives the idea. So if this is your pavement condition, starting at 100 and then drifting down over time, getting worse over time, you know, in the old days, you might get down to here and resurface, but that resurfacing might cost, in the example they say here, $16 or, you know, $4 here to do a rehabilitation. But if we'd have done something up here when it was in a little better shape, we could do a cheaper treatment and it would last longer. So in the life cycle of the pavement, we maybe wanted to go here. We're doing a bunch of smaller treatments, keeping that PCR up and making it better. So we can avoid these big expensive projects later. The problem with that is you got to put a lot of money up front to do it, which I guess we bit the bullet and started doing it. And the transition's been pretty good. The other issue is, exactly what is this treatment that you do? And it's going to vary depending on the condition of the pavement and the particular distresses. And where do you do it? You know, do you do it here? Do you do it down here? How much? And we have a computerized system that we've used to do this. And we put in a tremendous amount of data. Information about the pavement, the stresses, and the history of the pavement. When it was paved last, how long it lasts, the type of pavement, information about the potential treatments we could use on it, which I'll talk a little bit about, and the costs of those treatments and how long they might last. What else I wrote down? So there's a lot of information going into this database, and in fact, it's so big that it's one of the few things that's computerized now that you don't click a button and get an answer. You know, we're running this on our high-priced system down in Columbus, and it's still an overnight run. And when I get the data file out of this for our district, I'm getting it in a spreadsheet form. They're running it on the servers down there, and they reduce it to a spreadsheet. And the spreadsheet has 60,000 lines on it, with something like, I don't know, 80 or 90 columns. A lot of the columns are hidden just to make it manageable. So it gives you an idea of the magnitude of what's going into this. And it's pretty extensive. We've been doing this for 3 years now. But we basically settled on 5 different treatments for our pavements, and each of those treatments kind of have variations. Some of them more variations than others. Crack sealing, which would be done very early in the life of the pavement. Chip sealing, high tech, which is a very inexpensive but very effective treatment, but only in certain situations. And we have a threshold that we use for that. We only use it in low traffic areas, which basically means none of Summit County and only Northeast Portage County. And we've used that in a few cases, going back a number of years, and with pretty good luck. I know we're certainly, as ODOT, not experts on chip sealing. We've, in many cases, gone to the county engineers or whatever as the experts on that, because we don't have a good history with it, certainly not in the more urban
districts. You're talking about doing the whole road with chip and seal?
Yes.
Is there just gravel underneath of that?
No. We're putting a chip seal over an old road.
Over an old asphalt?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you usually mill it?
No, not with chip seal. We're usually not milling.
Over on top of
it, which is another thing. Chip seal on a roadway that is too far gone won't work.
Uh-huh.
And a roadway that has significant irregularities won't work either.
So like it was a bad base and it was like undulating.
Right. Yeah. We're not going to use chip seal on that. The system will pick that up.
And I'm assuming like with the crack sealing, I mean, that's literally just when you see people on the road filling cracks with
a wand.
Yeah, with the black tar.
The history of crack sealing is it's done too late and too much.
Mm-hmm.
Really, to do it right and for it to be effective, you want to hit it early on when you don't have a lot of cracks. If the crews are out there painting the roadway half black,
it's too late. Yeah.
It's too late. And that's something that we're trying to predict a little better, but that's something we've been trying to predict a little better for 15 or 20 years now. I don't know how good we're getting at it. You know, another thing we've done with chip seal is we're using it as an interlayer. So we will go out and maybe mill off a roadway. We'll be doing this on 261 around Kent here in another year or two. We'll mill the surface off, put the chip seal down as an interlayer, and then we'll top it off with asphalt. And we've done that in a few cases, and it's been very effective where we've used it. And it's not terribly expensive. $14 outside of Ravenna, we did probably 10 or 12 years ago, and it's performed very well.
And just, again, the crack sealing is really cheap, right?
Relatively
speaking. And then chip and seal, I'm assuming, gets a little bit, but it's still relatively inexpensive compared to
surface. In fact, I'm working my way up from least expensive to most expensive. The other thing that we're using is microsurfacing, which we've used here and there in the past, but a lot of times we've used it as a skid correction method. It is a very fine sand. I almost don't want to call it asphalt because it's more of a liquid with the sand in it, and it's squeegeed on the roadway. It takes specialized equipment. If you want to see what it looked like, we just did it this week down on 224 at Springfield Lake, around there. It only works with certain types of distresses, too. Works really good for things where you have an old pavement that's performed well, that's just oxidizing. It's maybe getting to the point where the stones will start popping out, turning very white, the surface looks open, and it'll seal that up and help that pavement last.
And what's that one called again?
Microsurfacing. There's some proprietary names for it, too. You may have heard of it as Rolumac. The problem we've run into with it is there's no, because it takes some proprietary equipment to put down, or maybe not proprietary, but very specialized, there's only a couple of contractors that have it, and we expanded the amount we did, and we actually reached industry capacity, so we had some contractors coming in from out of state, and it actually drove our prices up.
Yeah.
So when we did the next run for our pavement management system, we had to put an increased price in there.
Yeah.
And it actually decreased the amount that we're seeing the system project. So the next system that we use is what we call a thin poly treatment. You mentioned before somebody was asking about the rubber pavements.
Yeah.
And this is probably the closest thing to a rubber pavement that you have. We've been using it here in the district for probably 15 years with very good luck, some variations on it anyway. It's an asphalt. The average person won't be able to tell the difference between it, a thin poly treatment and a regular asphalt. If you saw them next to each other, you could tell there was something different, but it tends to be a very fine-graded, very tight mix because it's got finer aggregates in it. It has a higher asphalt content, and the asphalt, the liquid part of the mix, the binder, is a better quality. It's called poly because it's got styrene, butyl styrene, something like that in it. But it's got a polymer additive into the asphalt that makes it a lot more flexible. And you would think that would be a lot more expensive, and it is somewhat more expensive, but because of the nature of the mix, we can put it down thinner too, which knocks the price down. And in the right situation, it's an exceptional mix. We put some down up in Stowe 15 years ago, and, you know, we're just now getting to the point where we're even thinking about doing.
And do you mill on that one, or is that like a?
You can mill or you can not mill, uh-huh. And that's one of the problems our initial run on the PMS gave us. It wasn't calculating any mills into the system, which adds a little bit of cost.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had to add some extra costs in. Yeah. It's thick enough that in a situation where you have a curb, you really need to mill.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you end up with grade differences and you cause drainage problems.
Right. Okay.
So we also like to mix that up into our regular resurfacing program when we're doing a two-course. You know, maybe we'll do 2.5 inches. We'll do 1.5 inches of a regular intermediate course mix of asphalt, which has a larger stone, and then we'll put a 1-inch top of this on top of it. And it's a very good mix in that application. So, and then we have our standard resurfacing program, which is still probably a quarter to a third of our overall program that we're doing. There's still a lot of it out there. The more preventative maintenance that we do, or the more we get into that, that percent should probably go down. And there's a lot of variation in that too. You can do 1 course, 2 course, you can mill, you can not mill, how much patching you do beforehand, the specific materials that you use for the mix. Up here, a few years back, we switched exclusively a better grade of binder in our asphalt. It's a little more expensive, but we found it works a lot better, especially with the weather that we get up here. There's even better grades that are significantly more expensive and hard to get that we've used in very specific situations where we have, for example, high truck turning volumes or stopping volumes that cause rutting. We can adjust the aggregate mix and the binder type and content to correct that. We've had a lot of trouble, for example, with bridge waterproofing, We used to overlay bridges with asphalt, and you would put a fabric waterproofing underneath of that asphalt. We've had a lot of failures of that. It ends up peeling up and getting a lot of potholes. Well, we've developed some mixes of asphalt that are essentially waterproof for that situation where we don't have that problem.
When you say things like we develop, is it a lot of trial and error from the district perspective, or is it a central, is there a central that's actually doing research on binding agents and mixes and all that?
A little bit of both. Okay. I mean, I mentioned that we've been using that thin poly treatment for a number of years. We've been way out ahead of what they've done across the state in that. And I think the good results we've had in that certainly made statewide adoption of that as one of our preventative maintenance mixes broader. But we have people in Columbus that are constantly looking at that, and they coordinate with all of the districts. But a lot of the districts are dealing with different problems. You know, we have weather issues and traffic issues up here. You know, out in, you know, I talked about raveling. We don't have raveling. Raveling is a problem that you get typically on an older pavement that's performed well for a long number of years. The binder, I said, oxidizes. So the oxygen in the air reacts with the binder, and it loses its flexibility. And eventually what happens is the aggregate start stripping out of it. Well, because of the traffic and the weather here, that's not our failure mechanism. But in some parts of the state, you know, like west central Ohio, that, you know, where they don't have a lot of traffic, the weather's not quite what we're facing, you know, that's their failure mechanism, and they have to deal with that. So they've developed some means of doing that. You know, districts that have a lot of low volume roads, they actually have their own chip seal crews, and they're doing it in house. That wouldn't make any sense at all for us. So, you know, a lot of times the districts become the experts more than the central office can. One of the things that everybody that has this issue is struggling with, and there's a little bit of it in Portage County, is how do you deal with horse-drawn vehicles? I don't know if you got the Amish areas.
Yeah.
We have some down in southern Stark County, more in northern Trumbull and southern Ashtabula, but the horse-drawn vehicles typically have steel wheels, and you've got the horseshoes, and they tear up certain types of pavement, or the pavements don't last. And I don't know that anybody's really figured out a good way to deal with that yet.
They're not heavy.
No, it's abrasive.
Yeah.
It's more abrasive than anything. You know, rubber's really not abrasive on asphalt.
Right.
That asphalt's designed for it. But, you know.
So you start hitting it with steel over and over again.
Yeah. So.
Narrow for all that weight. Like
So anyway, all those variations and those treatments go into that system, and it spits out suggested treatments for every segment of roadway that we manage, except for urban. We haven't included the state routes in the cities in this program yet.
So one of your urban paving program is still sort of using worst first?
Yes. And I mentioned before that we're looking at, we're revisiting the urban paving policy, and that's one of the things we're looking at. How to, because they are really a city roads, how to encourage the preventative maintenance and fund that program. or, you know, and we don't know exactly how we're going to do it yet. It's not an easy question because it's more than just engineering. There's a lot of politics involved, and not just politics, it's local politics. and it's local politics among vastly different entities. So, you know, when Akron looked at a certain policy, they might look at it entirely different than Youngstown or Stowe, or what's your smallest one? Reminderville?
Reminder. Well, it used to be Brady Lake.
You know, so
Brady Lake still hasn't dissolved.
They haven't officially?
What? They have not officially dissolved yet.
Somebody took the signs down there.
Was it ODOT?
They have to certify. No. There's two more plats to go to record.
Well, and don't they still also need to be absorbed as well? Like,
they just need to. The county, the village clerk needs to certify her results to the county recorder.
Okay.
Once that happens, the village is done.
But then is it...
I think it's automatically in Franklin Township.
Is it automatically? Because I thought Franklin County or Franklin Township had to do something.
I don't think so,
really?
Because I would have heard from... The prosecutor told me that that's not
okay.
The case.
That's,
she
that's
has not
a fascinating
that.
Issue.
Well, I know a lot about those particular fascinating officials in that
neighborhood.
We're not
the
only one.
We should all be able to... Of course, we can't say a word about it. It's just not right.
But the system gives us all these recommendations. Sometimes the recommendations aren't that practical in the sense that it'll give me a recommendation for a stretch of pavement that goes from here to the wall.
Right.
That is in between two other segments that, you know, are miles long. Mm-hmm. And, and, you know, it just doesn't make sense to set up little projects like that. So we have to manually set up our projects and try to match as best we can what that is, what the recommendations are from year to year. We found that the system in some cases we've had to change the logic, and for some reason it didn't want us to do anything to State Route 11 over in Trumbull County at all. It's almost like it was left out of the system, but it told us to do nothing, and the projection showed the pavement going, you know, down into the 50s, which, you know,
it's like a glitch in your spreadsheet. Why it didn't tell you something?
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly because there's so much going on in there that it's hard to understand everything.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Is that, I mean, just from your perspective, or to give it a little bit more context, is so. Yeah, the AMAT system, Summit, Portage County, and a little bit of Wayne, but you've also got Stark, Mahoning, Trumbull, and Ashtabula.
Correct.
So when you're getting these sheets, it's not just for our network, it's for, you know, what, five counties?
Six county
network, and it just seems like it'd be very difficult to stay on top of that type of preventative maintenance for a network that large.
Yeah. And, I don't know. The guys tease me because I've got this huge spreadsheet. They got me an extra monitor so I could look at more than one thing at once. But they say it's like when I'm in the Matrix,
right?
The numbers and stuff. And it kind of hits like that.
Right.
And I talked about the 60,000 line spreadsheet. Well, the first thing that I do is hide columns that don't really mean a lot. Now, at some point, they may mean something to somebody, right. But I hide columns. And I start filtering, and I work it into manageable things, and then I'll work things, and then back up, see what it does. Run it back through a separate system that does some projections, and that one only takes about 10 minutes to run. But, you know, there's a few iterations there, and there's a lot of sanity checks that go into it. And even when I say, okay, we're going to do a micro-surfacing on this stretch of roadway in 2019, I've got a guy that writes up the project scope. And he'll go out and he'll take one of the designers out with him, and maybe one of the construction guys or the county maintenance guys. And they'll drive through the route slow and look at things and say, does this make sense? And so far, we found that we're probably 90% plus. We're happy with the treatment. We tweak around the edges a little bit. know, sometimes kind of a typical problem is it'll say, do microsurfacing for this 5 miles. And there may be two intersections in there that have significant rutting right at the intersection that the microsurfacing won't fix. So we'll set up to get that fixed by a different method before we do the microsurfacing. Usually a little, just a quick mill and fill, and then we'll microsurface over it, and it makes for a good treatment. So, in a nutshell, that's where we've gone with our pavement management. I brought maps of what we have planned for Portage and Summit counties. I didn't do Wayne.
It's two townships.
Well, it's in another district.
That's true.
Right, there you go.
But since we did this, we had to redo how we do our maps, too. We used to just color it by year, and now we've had to use some different symbology to indicate the different treatments to make it easier to understand. So, you know, squiggly lines are fine-graded polys, and the stars are microsurfacing with the colors representing the various years. Did I mention this is all constrained by budget? So,
Jack, do you think maybe you could just point out some of the major projects that, you know, I know like the Howe Road, the State Route 8 construction project, you know, on the major reconstruction or just, you know, for the good of the order, so to speak? Or?
Well, yeah, and State Route 8 is kind of an interesting one, and I'm not sure exactly which one you're talking about, but the portion in Stowe and Hudson, that section was built in, let's see, it opened the day I started at ODOT in 1988 or 89. Something, I'm dating myself. But it was built with a concrete pavement, and the concrete pavement was built with 40-foot joints, which is about double what we would use now, and it was built with using a less coarse aggregate than we would use now. And the effect of that was that every slab's got two transverse cracks in it, and the cracks are working cracks. So a lot of times when you get that crack, especially with the larger aggregates, you get what we call aggregate interlock, and it holds it together. That didn't happen there, so all the slabs up there, even though the pavements for that, we got a lot of pavements from the 60s doing better than that, but the slabs are working, and we're going to replace the whole pavement. We've probably put $10 million into it in the past 10 years, just trying to hold it together.
That's why when you're driving down the road, you feel the seams?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because you can, if you drive a pickup truck, you can feel every single one of them, and it'll rattle your teeth. So certain vehicles, you can feel it a lot more than others.
And I mean, like you said, because I remember it was within the last 10 years, they were doing tons of work where they were cutting out the joint, you know, like, and just, and so now there's new concrete on top of, or, you know, next to older concrete. It's just looks real sloppy out there. Like, I guess from that perspective, like, will ODOT ever build another concrete road? Like,
yes.
So are there still places, because we're finding is places like in Talmadge and Coyote Falls, the Howe Road corridor, which is concrete, the local communities where ODOT doesn't have jurisdiction, they don't know how to fix their concrete roads because there's no mill it down, and it's, you've got to replace the concrete. So you're looking at, you know, Talmadge is looking at to replace Howe Road, you know, four lanes wide of concrete. They're saying, like, we would never build a concrete road again because we can't maintain it well.
The East Lake in Akron, which was built in concrete around 93, 94, has performed pretty well.
Yeah.
The guy I mentioned that goes out and looks at the pavements just went up to Ashtabula and looked at a section of Ashtabula 90 that we built in concrete. And he came back and he said, cancel the project.
Yeah.
We don't have to do anything up here for a while.
So it can't, is it more about the installation, like who the contractor and pouring, all that stuff? I mean, or is it just there's so many different factors? And
there's a lot of different factors. One of the advantages that we had here over here on the East Lake in Akron was all the embankments had been there for 30 or 40 years already, so we got all the settlement that we were going to get already.
Yeah.
So if you build new embankments,
then you've got settlement.
You get so much settlement that happens right away, but over the years it's going to settle additionally. You know, the geotechnical guys draw curves and they pretend they can predict the settlement. But you can only predict it so much, and you know it's going to happen. And concrete pavements are just more susceptible to that than the asphalt. From our standpoint, the bigger issue, because we can fix concrete, is maintenance of traffic when you're fixing it. Because we can go out there at night, mill something off, and let the traffic back on it in the morning, and everybody complains about the duster kicking up.
Right.
But the next day, you know, you pave through and you do it overnight. You know, somebody was on vacation for a week, they come back, oh, we got a new road here. And they, you know, and the people that commute every day, they may have kicked up some dust after we milled it, but they didn't get stuck in a traffic jam. Can't do that with concrete.
Right.
There's some things you can do to accelerate the cure, but they're typically, they lead to a product that's not quite as good.
Yeah.
So, we have, 95% plus of our system has an asphalt surface on it.
Mm.
So, the concrete pavements are almost treated separately.
Yeah.
I mean, they're treated the same, but as an effective measure because of the difference in the pavement type, they're really separate. We used to overlay the old concrete pavements a lot, which results in what we would call a composite pavement.
Yeah.
But a lot of us believe that what you end up getting is the worst of the asphalt and the worst of the concrete.
Right.
So, although, I got to say, the Springfield Lake was built composite new, 224 around there, and it's really performed pretty good.
Yeah.
But that's the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a question, Jack, and I think it's not really within your authority. But so as an urban dweller, someone living in Akron riding a bicycle, a lot of Akron streets are brick streets. And then in terms of the maintenance on that, they seem to think they don't really, what do they need? Not much. But the ones I've also noticed sometimes, I don't know whether it's a historic preservation, but some have been replaced with stamped material, and it doesn't look like it lasts very long. I mean, but anyway, I guess I'm asking, you don't have any, as far as a brick paving surface, do you have anything about the maintenance of something like that, or is it all within, that's all?
That's fine. I would think that some state, I mean, maybe not this.
We've got brick underneath.
Yeah.
And we might have some brick crosswalks, but Canton has a lot of brick streets. They've done a lot of maintenance on their brick streets. Dan Meglin, who used to work for the Summit County engineer here, and ODOT, has been down at Canton for a while. And I know he's done some things with maintaining brick streets, but a lot of times that has more to do with when the bases fail than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Brick streets really don't function that well with high traffic volumes or faster traffic.
Yeah.
They tend to be pretty slick too, which is one of the reasons why it doesn't work that well with faster traffic. But we also we've got a lot of brick, I don't want to say a lot, but significant amount of brick bases and
mm-hmm.
With enough asphalt on it, it's okay. But a lot of them just have thin asphalt over it, and that's kind of.
I think in some cases, Akron, they'll dig out the brick and put some kind of new base under where there's, say, a big... I just don't know how often and how much... I mean, they've got a lot of local streets that are brick, you know, which is...
Tends to be very labor-intensive.
Yeah.
You know, paving crew, you know, you have... typical paving crew is less than 10 people, and you're talking about doing miles in a day. So, you know, you do a couple of those brick patches and... I'm not sure how bicyclists like brick roads.
Not so much, but I'm also an architect, so. I'll
yeah, well. Yeah. I mean, we've done. I mean, we've done a lot of stamped concrete. I know Akron does a lot instead of tree lawns now. It's lower maintenance than tree lawns, unless you get the homeowners to do it. It does look pretty good. The prices of it have really come down. We've started doing, you know, it's a, switching topics a little bit. But, we do a lot of form liner work on bridges for aesthetic reasons. And some of that really comes out nice. Akron's done some really nice stuff with that on a few of their bridges they've done. And there's one back behind the old Goodyear headquarters. Just a smaller bridge that they did some stuff on that looks really good. If you didn't, at first glance, you might think that it is, you know, the original sandstone or something. It's a little shiny for that. But, there's a lot of things with form liners and concrete for aesthetics that really isn't all that expensive. And you could do specialty type stuff too. We've done a lot of city name imprints in bridge parapets that don't cost that much. And ODOT will pay for that up to a certain amount. We like to keep single-digit percentages for aesthetic treatments and stuff like that. And we do a lot with sealer colors and paint colors on beams and things like that. Akron has a certain scheme that they like, with a brown steel beam painting and then more of a buff neutral sealer that looks pretty good.
And the so word Akron.
Everyone knows that bridge.
Yes. That was the first foray, I think, into some sort of aesthetics like that.
Unfortunate.
Well, in, you know, some of the early tries at things like that. Some of the early landscaping stuff just turned into a nightmare.
Yeah.
Maintenance nightmare. Other stuff is done pretty good. Some stuff Akron's done is pretty good with some of the bulk planting along slopes where they don't have to mow it now, and once it grows in, it's pretty good. Catches a lot of trash in there, but you can't see it.
Right. On your... going back to your spreadsheet with 60,000 lines, how is there a GIS component of that database that you use, or is it really just a spreadsheet?
We have GIS, but the GIS is a front end that we can hit our databases with. So these are all done with our GIS.
But I mean, do you use the GIS to help you with that data that you put in order to, you know, get your big conclusion that you get?
Yes, in fact, and he'd be glad to help the counties. In fact, he has. Jim Bruner is our GIS guy in the district, and he's very good. He's helped a lot of local government entities, and he's trained a lot of interns that have gone on and worked in other places and are doing some good things. I know, I think at least one or two of his interns are working over at Eastgate now, which is over in the Youngstown area. There's a lot of things we can do with the data through mapping that it's pretty remarkable. One of the first things we did when we started getting this capability is we started mapping all of our project. Now, the first thing you have to do is make sure the data in your database is good. But when we started mapping our project limits, we played with the line weights and things, and we tried to identify overlaps in projects and gaps between projects. Which, when you're looking at a big grid of numbers, isn't the easiest thing to see,
right.
But it sticks out like a sore thumb on a map.
That's why I was wondering if you can use GIS to help you do your job with this spreadsheet.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of things that we do. Jim developed, I do bridges too. Jim developed a method of what we call bullseyes. So we'll map our certain bridge conditions as a dot on the map location. And then we'll map, overlay that with another dot for projects addressing that condition.
Mm-hmm.
And then depending on the size of the dots, you can see every bridge with a deficiency that's being addressed and ones that aren't being addressed.
Right.
And with bridges, it works out particularly well because what we can do then is we can say, okay, we have this bridge that we need to address. Well, it's a lot easier to put that same work into an adjacent project than to set up your own project. We do that all the time. That's really nice for us, especially because this has all been about pavement, but we're doing similar stuff with bridges now, too, that we've never done before. I review we have 1,430 bridges that we're responsible for in the district, and I review every inspection report and sign off on it. The maintenance of the bridges has been neglected by us for a long time. We really don't have many in-house forces, and nobody cares about the stuff you can't see.
Mm.
You know, everybody's, they'll run out and fix a pothole, and rightfully so, if somebody complains about it. But, you know, one of the problems that I've had is all our bridge joints leak. And what that leads to is the bearings on the bridge end up with debris sitting on them, and they rust, and they get jammed up, and the ends of the beams start rusting, and, you know, it's not the best for the life of the bridge. So as part of this preventative maintenance, we've added in preventative things for the bridges, too, and one of them is cleaning those joints out, cleaning the bridge seats out, and we're tracking that and doing that every 2 years. And from the standpoint of keeping the bridges long-lasting, that's a very good thing. We're also sweeping bridges because the drainage systems tend to get clogged up. Especially a lot of the bridges that we're responsible for are what we would call overhead bridges. So the bridges over Route 11 in Trumbull County we're responsible for, even though it's carrying a state route.
Mm-hmm.
Well, out there there's no traffic, and they use grits, which is basically sand instead of salt to melt it. So they put that down for traction. Well, it ends up sitting on a bridge and clogging up all the drainage. And so we go out in the spring and we're sweeping those now. And it helps us out a lot.
Jack, I'll let you take a breather for a second. I just wanted to also, from the standpoint of giving Jack a break, but also kind of maybe just move into the open section. So if you guys do have any comments or questions,
I thought we were in that already.
Well, yeah, I mean, we kind of are, but just if there's anything other than off the topic of pavement, too, we'd be happy to answer any questions. Or if I know you're interested in biking, I don't want to at least give you time if there was something specific you wanted to mention or anything like that. So, but at this point, we'll be open, and then I think usually they start to try to kick us out of here in 20 minutes or so, 7:45 or 7:50. So. So if there's any other questions or if there's more, Jack, that you want to add? Obviously, I was thinking of big projects, the Route 8 bridge over the valley. I mean, that's going to be a huge project, replacing the Route 8 bridge over as it comes into Perkins. I mean, there's going to be some major Orange Barrel-type projects in the next 4 or 5 years. I mean, you think about Route 8 and the bridge, you know, all that stuff is going to be happening back to back, or in some cases the same year. So that'll be a fun maintenance of traffic. A lot of unhappy commuters coming from the north.
Route 8 actually isn't too bad because we're building a new bridge next to the existing bridge.
Right. So it should
putting all the traffic there. And that bridge is actually going to be bigger than the existing one.
Yeah.
And we're going to tear down the existing bridge, build a second new bridge on the location of the existing one,
right,
and then move
half the traffic
over to that.
Yeah.
Although
are
some of the switches.
Two bridges there, though?
Yes.
Oh.
But it's all traffic driven. You know, we've got three lanes in each direction there now.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have four lanes in each direction when we get done, but the one additional lane is an auxiliary lane, and then we'll have wider shoulders. So it's not like we're building extra, it's just that the way it works out.
Well, in the PM peak, you know, the on-ramps are so short to get on Route 8, especially when you're going northbound, which is the way I travel, is that, I mean, you just get that. It's almost immediate. You get off the ramp and you got to merge over. And so this is going to just allow people to get on and keep cruising and give them a good distance before they have to get over. So I think it's going to be a really good improvement. So
are they going to have to rebuild the bridge at Glenwood?
No.
No.
Our limits are from Perkins to Glenwood, and we're not touching either of those bridges. We'll touch the ramps on the north side of Glenwood and south side of south side of Glenwood, north side of Perkins.
In the end, I think we'll still eventually have to do something about the bridge over Perkins. I mean, with Stark State and additional development in the hospital, it's not good now.
Yeah, we had some discussion about
that.
We're going to talk to the city about traffic analysis there. So if there's anything we need to do while we're doing
what we're doing, we can
accommodate.
Yeah. So Dave Galay from our staff has a dream of two roundabouts as you get off an exit.
It's been done in a lot of places.
Yeah. I don't know if there's
not
enough
sure
room
if that's
out
the base
there.
That's there.
Yeah, but I always think that eventually something's going to happen. It's going to have to. There's got to be more capacity to get on that. Yeah, to get on and off the meter over there. But
all right, open season, open time. So yes, my interest is bicycles, and I had read something with Jason Segedy that there was a plan for creating new trails networks along in industrial older and industrial tracks in Akron, and I just wondered whether whether this was something that was moving forward or what.
Well, the one that I'm most familiar with, and I don't know what specifically he was talking about, the one that is that we're starting to fund now from a planning and design perspective is called the Rubber City Heritage Trail,
mm-hmm.
and that's the one that will go from Goodyear, roughly Goodyear area, through an old railway corridor, through some of the industrial stuff to almost about where Exchange and Route 8 are near the university,
mm-hmm.
and then that track follows south and heads towards almost like towards the Kenmore area, but
mm-hmm.
I think I can't remember where. Eventually, the hope is to get it to hit the towpath trail,
right.
And I think it might be south of Summit Lake. That's
right.
The part
so,
I'm.
Yeah.
I think that's where. And
well, that's where they kind of intersect.
Yeah. And so right now there's a plan that AMATS has got. Our agency has got some funding in. The city does, and the Ohio and Erie Canal Way Coalition. We've just hired a consultant, GPD, to start a design of that. And the hope is that they'll actually be coming to our agency for trail funding come September.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the federal process of developing the trail, so it could be by the time you actually see trail, it could be, in a perfect world, 4 years from now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
on the Freedom Trail.
And then you have the Freedom Trail,
which is a good portion of it's under construction.
Right, so the Freedom Trail, the purpose of the Freedom Trail, where it is right now, is they're building it that should take you along the old rail line, basically from what is it, Eastwoods? Eastwoods is the road that right now the terminus. Eastwood.
Up in Talmadge.
Well, it's through Talmadge now, and it's in Akron, but I can't, what is that road? Eastland? East something. He's one of the Goodyear Heights, and it's going to keep going, and it actually goes by the old Acme Bread Company building right near Route 8, follows those rail corridors, and comes down, and it'll end up at Mill Street in the university.
Mm-hmm.
The next phase of that, which has funding, is going from Mill Street south through downtown in the rail corridor. You know, it's kind of, if you can imagine where like the university street is and the bridge over that rail corridor, it's going to come all the way down to the transit center and then cross over Broadway and towards the Spaghetti Warehouse and kind of the towpath there.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're looking at, Metro Parks has a few concepts of a pedestrian bridge over Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're going to send people across Broadway, especially with the main Broadway project that ODOT's doing, where it's going to be high traffic or high speed, almost ramps. I think it's going to feel, some cars are just going to be coming right off the highway going 50. We don't want bike and ped crossing there. I think it would be just a terrible situation. So I think Metro Parks acknowledges that, and they're looking to do a pedestrian bridge there. Those are the two big trails that I think are, well, Freedom for sure is going to happen. There's money in it. The Rubber City Heritage is one that is starting to be designed and looked at for development. I'm trying to think if there would be anything else. The Springfield area, the Spartan Trail, they're looking to do a continuation of that. I mean, that's obviously outside of Akron, but very close to Akron. And then, let's see, how one that would be relatively close.
Green just started a plan, too.
Yeah,
you guys funded it.
Well, yeah, we're funding Green. We've got a Connecting Communities grant with Green right now that's looking at pretty much doing a bike plan, master connectivity plan. We've also got a master connectivity plan going in Twinsburg. And actually in Kent right now, we're looking at repurposing part of 261, possibly doing a road diet there, which would be,
narrowing the road?
Well, in the case of 261, it's in the limited access portion, so it might actually be, abandoning
part
of vacating, yeah.
Right.
And moving the traffic to three lane.
Yeah, making it more narrow.
Exactly, yeah. That's another that's being looked at. It's not like a decision's been made, but they're looking at, hey, what if we did this? Could we actually improve safety at 43 and 261, which is a major issue near the university? And they're looking at that. And then in Barberton, we helped fund, and they're doing the Magic Mile that goes off the towpath, and that's kind of also an industrial.
Yeah.
It takes you to downtown Barberton, around Lake Anna,
yeah,
and potentially, eventually, connecting into what's being called the Pigeon Creek Wolf Creek network of trails, which follows old rail lines around the Wolf Creek, Pigeon Creek, the two creeks out there. That one, there's been a study to look at basic planning, can it be done? But I'm not sure if it's being pursued right now.
One of the things that Dan Rice and the coalition's looking at too is, once you punch the trails through, that's a lot of times that's the hard part. But then some of these areas, especially industrial areas, you got to make it inviting and welcoming too. And they've been doing some things to the existing trails to try to do that.
Right
here in Akron, they've made some improvements to, they said people would come up from, down in the valley,
right,
and they'd get up there.
Quaker Street.
And it looked intimidating,
right,
to them, and they made some small improvements, and they thought...
Yeah, a lot of signage and softening things, and I think that does make a difference. One of the issues, too, that we have with the industrial stuff is, you know, Akron, like for this Rubber City Heritage Trail, Akron owns all this vacated track up until this last piece that's between
may
the towpath and where the speed
the
trail
library,
is. And so then you get to that point, and you're not going to be able to follow that right of way all the way. So then it's how do you, and that's where trail planning gets really complicated, is sort of how do you move, you know, what, where in the right of way can you find that opportunity? And that was the same really with the, talking about that Broadway where Metro Parks decided to bring the Freedom Trail out is, it wasn't that, oh, Broadway is the perfect place to bring people across. It was, this is the best of three not so great choices of where we can bring people across.
And that chunk that isn't owned by Akron, who owns it?
It's an existing business, I think, owns the, I think in the, from my recollection of the discussion we had, there's a piece that's still, or it might even be owned by the railway still, that they still own a piece, and then further on they own more. And that's an issue too with the free, and depending on who owns it, you know, certain railroads have better reputations than others. None of them have good reputations, but some of them are even more difficult to work with than others. And so those, that creates some real challenges too.
And some of it's not because the railroads are trying to be difficult or anything. It's just they have more impenetrable bureaucracy than any of our governments do. Well, in some, I deal with a lot of different localities too, and you know, sometimes the bureaucracy is the biggest problem that, that we have to deal with.
Well, it's like finding the right person who has the right ability to make a decision.
And you know, and frankly, they're still, you know, like rolling stock. I mean, those still, the rail lines are active. All of them, but
Because one of the things we've even looked at, if you're familiar with the North Side, and you know where Luigi's is and all that, and you know, they put the hotel in, and we've been saying, okay, well, people are going to want to walk from the hotel to downtown, you know, to Crave and all that stuff. And the way that the that it looks is, if you're coming out of the hotel and you look and you're like, I can just walk down this parking lot across. Well, then there's, you realize there's no sidewalks, like you're walking over a rail line, but that's still the path of least resistance.
Right.
But they're not allowed to do anything there because it's an active rail line.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, you can't just put even, you know, the city doesn't even want to put down aggregate gravel to, because then the railroad would be like, well, you can't invite people to cross over our track, you know. And so it just creates that really awkward conundrum of, like, you almost have to leave it the way it is and assume 90% of people are going to go that way anyway, but you can't officially say that's the easiest way to get there. You know, there's some other places I know where, you know, they've actually kind of just had agreements off the road. Okay, like, somebody kept ripping off this piece of fence so they could cross this rail, and, you know, the railroad says, all right, well, we're just not going to replace it anymore. And the city says, okay, that's a good idea. You know, and they just have, like, an agreement that is, you know, because that's the only way it can work. And it gets almost silly at that point. But, you know, I always feel like working on trail projects is always the most fun and the most frustrating. That you hit some of those trouble spots, and there's, you know, it's a lot of tough choices to make. Any other comments or questions? Or now, are you a bike supporter from the standpoint of, you like bike lanes or multi-purpose trails, or?
I'm more of a bike. Though I have a driver's license, I've never owned a car. So bicycles, sort of my transportation more.
Okay.
So
you're looking to use it
all the time.
Yeah.
So
down Market Street or wherever.
So the whole, you know, an increase in the capacity for to encourage people to ride bikes is of interest, of course, to me. But that's sort of.
I feel like this is my cue to let you know we're having Switching Gears conference coming up in July.
Great. Okay.
It's in Barberton. We're having a Switching Gears conference July 26th to encourage cycling in all communities.
Okay.
Chuck Marone there from Strong Town speaking.
Jason Roberts will be back from Better Walk.
And we'll be doing a ride around Barberton, you know, showcasing some of the stuff they try to do to encourage biking and all that kind of stuff.
nice job. I know where to find the plug.
We're interested in encouraging cycling and transportation. That's what we're doing.
Well, yes, certainly am.
So good to see back.
Well, Jack, I mean, thanks a lot. I feel it was interesting to me. I hope it was interesting to everyone. I mean, it's always, you know, interesting to know how ODOT's making decisions and some of the challenges that you deal with in trying to make the right decision and getting to the right spot. And I think for us, I'm almost even curious about what you were saying about local communities and getting that. Like, that's something that I think we agree with, is that we want to promote our local communities to do the right kind of preventative maintenance instead of, because we fund worst to first right now, and we know that that's not the best way to do it, but we don't even have that kind of detailed data. I mean, like you said, it doesn't include municipalities, and it's like, so how do we as the Metropolitan Planning Organization help encourage our communities with carrots other than, you know, versus sticks to, you know, maybe do some of that stuff and identify those types of treatments? So I find that stuff really interesting. So.
It's a harder sell for a city that's got, you know, a lot worse roads than we have to say we're going to, you know, do this PM treatment on this road that's good, as opposed to, you know, fixing your road that, you know, looks like Beirut in 1982.
Yeah. Awesome.
Beirut, I understand, looks really nice now.
Well, I thank everybody for coming and appreciate your time, and we've got a, you know, our next regular meeting will be September 7th, so we encourage you to show up if you can. Thank you.